I'm Britta Wigginton.
I'm Brett Scholes.
And I'm Ellie Gibson.
We're a group of early career researchers.
And we're all from the International Society of Critical Health Psychology,
otherwise known as ISCHIP.
And you're listening to The Operative Word.
You're listening to the official podcast for the International Society of Critical Health Psychology, or ISCHIP for short. My name is Britta Wigginton, and I'm a lecturer from the University of Queensland, Brisbane, Australia. In this episode, we'll start with hearing from Dr. Ali Gibson, describing her five-minute challenge. Ali works in public health at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, and she manages the qualitative research hub there. Take it away, Ali.
In a recent experimental study, university students were asked to set up an account on a fictitious social networking site, NameDrop. Students were then observed for how they approached the terms of service and privacy policy. Did they go for the quick join option, circumventing the terms and conditions, or, if they did opt to read them, how long did they take? Needless to say, most students chose to skip the T's and C's, and those who did read them spent an average of 51 seconds. A document, if read properly, would take 30 minutes. Faced with information overload, these students reported the policies as a nuisance and a hindrance to reaching the end goal, that of creating their NameDrop account. As an aside, 98% of the students ended up agreeing to share their data with the NSA, their employers, and offering up their firstborn for the privilege of using NameDrop. Of course, what I've just described can't just be put down to lazy millennials. Particularly in the information overloaded world we live in today, we all give in to skipping over the fine print, brushing over the details to get to where we need to be or to reach our end goal. We also assume, when faced with this sort of standardized or jargon-loaded information, that it's a case of read one, read them all. We assume that the information is trustworthy, correct, or if nothing else, simply a formality to be ticked off as quickly as possible. And so, in more ways than one, we all end up clicking that button, saying we've done something we haven't really done. Now, I contend that in academia, the same could be said for how we sometimes approach the methods sections of journal articles. Not always, but quite often, methods sections are treated as bylines that have to be included in an article, but that don't require much thought or time. Just like the quick join option of NameDrop. As academics, we find ways around these pesky few paragraphs. Some of us use it as a handy backstop for reining in our verbosity and culling words when we're already pushing 7,651 words on a 7,000-word limit article. Other times, we have our trusty string of sentences that we know, from past experience, will get the job done, succinctly explaining our participant group, nodding to considerations of data saturation or team collaboration. And that, might I add, is what you're lucky enough to get in a good caliber qualitative journal. These shorthanded approaches are not necessarily problematic in and of themselves, particularly when you know the author or trust the journal has a rigorous review process. It does become more problematic when qualitative methods are adopted and reported in inexperienced or unreflexive ways, or with methodological catchphrases being thrown around with little justification or explanation. But doing justice to the myriad methodological considerations and reporting them faithfully can be challenging even for those of us who do specialize in using qualitative methods, and who pride ourselves on thinking through our methodological approach. With the tight word limits of journals, it can be difficult to explain or justify methodological decisions and processes in much meaningful detail. And perhaps, for some, that's a blessing, sparing readers from screeds of sometimes mind-numbing technicalities. However, we're now seeing a push for greater transparency in our reporting. Journals are encouraging authors to publish their data as supplemental files, for example, enabling readers to consider the credibility of authors' analytic interpretations and reporting. Although, that raises other questions that are currently up for debate. But perhaps the same needs to be done for method sections, where authors, for instance, provide greater detail in the review process, for the peers to get a clearer sense of what was actually done before applying the inevitable veneer of publication. Perhaps as authors, we need to be more transparent about our research process, more detailed, and given less to pat methodological phrases that sound good but don't actually portray the messiness of data collection and analysis. Because sometimes don't you wonder if your fellow academic, when you're reading their paper, in amidst funding deadlines and other commitments beyond article writing, did they really use constant comparison to recheck all of their codes, or did they just give in to one of the biggest lies on the internet?
What inspired you to talk about this for your challenge? Was it that you have a string of method sections that you felt you have been problematic, or?
That's Dr. Brett Scholes. He's a research fellow from the University of Canberra, Australia. Together, he and I are co-editing this episode of The Operative Word.
I think it's an issue that I've been grappling with for a while and thinking about. I mean, I've worked with a number of different teams. I've had a lot of different co-authors. We all have different styles of writing. And also in reviewing, I've noticed how people approach method sections quite differently. And kind of a recurring issue for me has been this idea of having your stock standard method section that you just kind of cut and paste and insert, and not really thinking through how that really matches up to what you did in the process. I know for myself that there've been times for various reasons that the method section I've written hasn't necessarily been true to decisions I've made, or haven't, I guess, allowed for those decisions to be explained in greater detail. So I felt like, drawing on my own experience, having had conversations with others, I remember actually, Britta will probably remember this as well, our previous PhD supervisor talking about salami publishing, I think it was, she used to say, of kind of slicing it up and just having this, you know, like bit that you inserted in when necessary. So yeah, I think I thought, well, let's actually think more critically about this. And especially because method sections are so often considered like the poor relation of the rest of the paper. And I guess, you know, like they often easier to write. And there is only, I guess, so many ways that you can write a method section. I guess that was my thinking behind it.
And I'm interested, Ali, because I think you're onto something in that this formality, this set of succinct, punchy bylines that we kind of rehearse for, in a way, to gain legitimacy through the review process, in a way to convince that we know the right things to say and how to say it. I mean, this has huge implications, your 5-minute challenge, for the review process. Are there some particular things that you would suggest or put forward as a way to deal with this jargon-loaded section?
That's a really good question, and something I've been thinking about, particularly in having been reviewing papers since giving the talk. And I would say certainly as a reviewer, but also to people writing the sections, is pay attention to the transparency of your writing or in reviewing a paper. You know, like how much explanation is given around decisions made about the method taken or the theoretical approach and how that actually shaped decisions made in the analysis. Being more clear about the sample group and why that group was selected. Especially if there's like a team involved, if there's more than one author, that the involvement of the different team members and how they played a role in data collection and analysis, actually explicating that is really important, because I think that really plays into the transparency of how the research process was shaped.
The use of passive voice, how do you think that plays a role in obscuring all of that agency and specific roles of authors?
A lot. And that's actually a point that I've been noticing in my own writing and in the reviewing, that I'm actually challenging people to use passive voice less, particularly in that meta section, because I think it allows, by taking up that active voice, you're putting ownership on those decisions and each author's involvement in the process. And I think that speaks to rigor, that then, you know, transparency is a really important aspect of promoting rigor and showing rigor in qualitative research, that you are explaining decisions and processes and justifying them, and that's then clearer to the reader, and then, you know, then it's open, you know, it's fair game for critique, or, you know, taking up ideas to follow something similar in the future in other research.
One thing that really resonated with me, and I imagine a lot of other people in the ISChip community, is I've read many papers, I've probably written some that have that use the word saturation almost as a way to justify something that may not have even really happened in the research process. I'm not sure exactly what my question around that is, but I just feel like, you know, there are these buzzwords that we sort of, that we know will get us published and might appease sort of a less critical reviewer, or a reviewer who comes from a quantitative paradigm and that kind of thing. Is that a bit of a challenge in that we need to publish our work and it's critical and it's important, and at the same time we might have to appease reviewers on the other hand?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a bit of a struggle, especially for those of us based in kind of health sciences, public health, even psychology, and you get such a broad range of reviewers and even co-authors, and having to kind of say, you know, try and push back a bit and say, this is why we shouldn't be using these terms, or it's not appropriate in this context. And funnily enough, after giving the 5-minute challenge at ISChip, I took up that idea because I wanted to explore it more beyond the 5 minutes, and ran an extended seminar at UNSW through the Qualitative Research Network Hub that I manage. And the seminar was all about this idea of my 5-minute challenge, but I was actually critiquing a lot of those terms like saturation. And I find, Kerry Chamberlain's paper on methodology, I think it's from about 2000.
Ali is referring here to Kerry Chamberlain's paper published in the Journal of Health Psychology. And we've got the DOI and the bio for this episode in case you're interested in checking it out.
Was fantastic for really kind of grappling with this idea and critiquing it. My take of what Kerry Chamberlain was saying was that we get caught up in method or methodology as a set of steps that need to be followed almost religiously, and that you can end up paying, getting too caught up in those details and not enough in the reasons why you're actually using that method or why it's appropriate. And so he says, you know, just be cautious of things like checklists, where, you know, it becomes too prescriptive, and that can actually obscure other things like, well, even allowing for some creativity in your use of methods, or exploring new ways of doing things, and also paying less attention to, well, why is this method appropriate, or methodological framework appropriate. I think one of the things was saturation is obviously one that gets thrown around a lot. And it's so hard because it's a great word for capturing, you know, a lengthy decision of when do you have enough interviews. At the end of the day, we have to remember that terms like saturation are contextualized and they're embedded in a particular theoretical framework. Mm-hmm. So, you know, something like saturation comes from a very particular paradigm of grounded theory, and it's not necessarily appropriate for research like, say, in discourse analysis. You don't need to reach saturation, or potentially it might not even be possible. So we need to think about how else can we defend those or explain those decisions that we make, and also bearing in mind that sometimes, you know, research isn't just guided by those sorts of decisions. There's also things like time and resources. Like, as researchers, sometimes we simply have to decide when is enough based on the limitations of our funding and time available. And I think being a little bit more transparent about that is actually worth saying. An interesting point that came out of this discussion that I led was the opportunity for more senior qualitative researchers, more established researchers, to start pushing back more against whether it's ethics committees, reviewers in more mainstream or biomedical journals that might not be familiar with qualitative research and think that those terms are vital for ensuring rigor, and encouraging senior researchers to use other terms or spell out decisions more. So essentially creating new pathways to show and enact rigor that would then allow for more junior academics, researchers to have a bit of a precedent to follow, that they don't feel so much of a need to use those catchphrases that they think they need to use.
And what about, Ali, in terms of, I'm thinking your call for transparent accounting is really important and a loud, I guess, message of your 5-minute challenge. I'm thinking of, say, listeners who are students and what they can do with this in the process of learning about methods and learning to write for particular journals.
I think that if, whether it's students or other researchers, feel that they need to use these terms or they find that they're appropriate for the method, that it's then using those terms but giving just a short explanation or definition to illustrate, and in relation to their data, whether that's giving an example, like in brackets, or just outlining how that step, you know, that methodological step fits into their approach to the data. I think that I've noticed in reading other people's work that when you see that, it then becomes a lot more, I don't know if honest is the right word, but yeah, I guess.
I'm wondering if what you're getting at, because I'm also cautious in this discussion of the way that we're talking about method sections is almost as though they can reflect or become this, almost in a realist sense, that they can represent what actually happened, what actually happened. So there's this kind of philosophical tension that we're here in this discussion. And if method sections are a bit of a rhetorical exercise for us as researchers, what does that mean for particular journals where reflexivity or, I guess, more transparency isn't necessarily invited or wanted and may actually subject us to more critique, potentially our paper being rejected because we over-explained.
That's a really good point. I would say there's certainly not one right way of going about this, and you really need to judge it based on the type of journal that you're going for. You know, we all know that those of us who've published in a more medical journal is very different to our publications that go into, say, feminism and psychology or qualitative health research. I would say that take into account your audience, the limitations, like the word limitations of that journal. And within those confines, you know, for more structured journals, yeah, keep it short. Just try and explain clearly what's been done and leave that exploration and more reflexive accounts for our critical longer length journals. But I think it's also a really good challenge back to me to think about, as you say, there isn't, we don't want to get into this idea that it's a realist depiction of what actually happened. But I do think there is a balance of needing to go beyond just like mindlessly describing what you think needs to be said. And I actually urge people to be more creative in explaining or justifying, as you say, like engaging in rhetorical work around their methodology or approaches taken in the research. So that might be presenting your method section quite differently, not necessarily doing it in the order that often is, you know, participants, data collection, data analysis, or whatever. It might be presented more in prose. You know, there's actually more room when you talk to researchers, particularly those based on arts-based methods. You realize that there's actually more room to play around with than you realize, and journals can actually be more open to it than you think. I would actually have a crack at doing that and then gauging what reviewers say. Obviously, again, I understand that more junior academics or students might not want to do that, but for those who are established and have a bit of a track record, again, it's like setting that precedent and showing people that there's more way than one to do this.
So, Ali, have you had any opportunities since giving us all that challenge to kind of apply this in your own work, or have you had discussions with co-authors that have kind of, you've been able to resolve some of these issues?
Certainly in terms of reviewing other people's papers, I've paid a lot more attention to the method section and am really kind of pushing people to give more details, justify things that they say they did. And then in turn, for myself, like recently I was working on a paper with some co-authors and same thing, like probably a method section that I would have ordinarily been like, yep, that's fine. It's, you know, it sufficiently explained our process. Yet at the same time, I actually went back and reworked it and gave a much more in-depth explanation of the analytic framework, examples of what we were looking at, what, say, a discrepant case might look like. Although it ended up extending my method section, I don't think what I'm proposing necessarily requires a substantially longer method section. It's being strategic about the words you use and how you're portraying your decisions.
I like that.
Ali, after ISCHIP went to the Psychology of Women section conference that's held by the British Psychological Society, and your 5-minute challenge came up in one of the and it was Ginny who raised it.
I'm referring to Virginia Brown, a professor from the University of Auckland.
Context of a feminism and psychology review panel. What Ginny was talking about was the implications of your 5-minute challenge for the review processes and whether there's opportunities to offer greater detail around particularly this issue of methods. I'm wondering if there's any other kind of tips you'd have that build on this idea of the review process and offering more detail, and whether that's in a separate kind of document altogether as a supplementary source, or if there's anything around that that you've thought of.
I mean, that's fantastic to hear that my challenge has already been taken up a little bit. I wonder, because I proposed it in the 5-minute challenge, of similar to how you can now provide your data in supplementary files to journals, which I think is interesting because it makes you think, like, what is the purpose behind that? Is it to check the accuracy of someone's analysis, which can be problematic if you come from a very critical perspective? But maybe using that supplemental file instead, or in addition to, providing more details on the methods section. So that could be having, you know, like an extended explanation of the methodological framework, like particularly if you are combining theories in new ways that might not be particularly familiar to, say, your reviewers. It might be that if you had, you know, a number of hurdles that you had to face in conducting your data collection, that, you know, like getting through gatekeepers or how you managed to do that, you know, that's information that you might not necessarily be able to put into a paper, but it might require some explanation in a supplemental file. But essentially anything, you know, like I've, on a number of occasions as a reviewer, have thought, well, why did you do it this way? Or I'd love some more details on that. That there are a number of opportunities for giving more information and explanation around that. And it doesn't have to be, I mean, we're talking like half a page to a page, a couple of pages. It doesn't have to be long, but just more information so that reviewers can look at it and say, okay, I understand why you went about it that way. I might not agree with it for, you know, other reasons. You know, I take a critical approach. You're taking a more interpretive approach, but I see why you made those decisions.
And some of that accounting work can happen in the review process, back and forth.
Yes. And that also ties into maybe another suggestion for authors is having, you know, don't feel like you need to just give in to reviewers' suggestions or comments, you know, just to kind of get the review done. But take that as an opportunity to say, no, I'm not going to use that phrase, or this is why I've made this decision because of, and give that explanation. And I think that, yeah, as you say, is where the back and forth comes in.
And I imagine that the knock-on effect of this, what you're calling for in more reflexive, transparent writing practice, the knock-on effect might be that students can see the diversity in terms of how method sections are written.
Precisely.
And they can be reflected in the results in terms of the presentation of analysis and be, in a way, normalized this process of accounting.
Because I know for myself, when I've read someone's method section and it's really clear and I see the process that they've taken, that then that just seems to enrich my reading of their analysis and findings. That, because I'm not sitting there questioning, well, how did they get from point A, being their raw data, to these interpretations and conclusions? So I think, if anything, you know, this doesn't have to be a futile exercise. It can actually improve your paper and the crux of your paper too.
Mm-hmm.
I've just been thinking while we've been chatting, Ali, about why I
feel a little nervous to kind of respond to your challenge. And I was kind of wondering, you know, why is this hard? And I think it's some of these shortcuts are so embedded in our practices and also in the way that we justify ourselves to others. So I was reflecting on sort of like when I collaborate with people who are a little bit outside the critical space, they assume that, you know, I might have done a discursive analysis, but they've assumed I've done a thematic analysis, and they sort of look particular terms in a method section and that kind of thing. But I'm almost in chatting, I've kind of reframed my nervousness, and I think it has really good potential to actually help explain a little bit better what I do to the people I'm collaborating with who assume I'm doing something else. So I'm looking forward to trying to, you know, challenge, I guess, the people around me with a more comprehensive, less appeasing method section.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
So thank you.
Yeah. But that's it. It's like, you know, this doesn't have to be a great overhaul of, you know, writing method sections.
Yes.
This is just taking little moments and opportunities of whether it's having a conversation with someone, a back and forth between author and reviewer, you know, expanding on some details in your method section. There are a number of points at which you can do this. And just by doing so, extend the opportunities for how we're writing and approaching the method section.
Mm.
It's almost like an exercise of resistance, or we're kind of disrupting unreflexive practice in a way, because even those, as you say, either it's an additional sentence to explain or unpack a concept, that in a sense is really pushing back at this idea that scientific practice is a set of well-rehearsed steps utter, and that in itself is legitimate or enough.
Absolutely. And it's funny, you think in particularly in qualitative research, you know, we promote reflexivity in our work, in writing, and yet we so often go about this particular section so unreflexively, as you say. Mm-hmm. So, and I mean, me included.
Yeah.
I guess a particular challenge for qualitative researchers is to kind of take their own, well, something that they already believe in and practice that more.
Yeah, I was almost thinking that kind of section of a method, which it kind of, in a way, I don't know.
Oh, confessional.
Yes, like the confessional. Yeah. And I wonder to what extent that is almost, and because that's seen, it's almost the thing is reflexivity is important qualitative research. Here is the reflexive section. So here's who I am, and that those set of statements about who I am in the research without careful integration into the analysis or into the theoretical framework. And so if that's kind of a peripheral, but maybe a similar issue with methods sections not being carefully thought through.
Well, I think that's it. It's like if you took that reflexivity and kind of wove it through your method section, and obviously, I mean, into the analysis is always great too. But so instead of having, you know, a couple of sentences where you just explain your position, but by making those decisions clear and your involvement in the research clear, that is speaking to reflexivity and answers the very question of, well, what role did you play in this research and how did you impact essentially the outcomes of your research? You know, and then that moves away from tacking on a couple of confessional sentences, which I'm sure, I don't know, it was like years ago that I think it was Ian Parker who critique the idea of saying, well, I'm a white middle class woman, you know, like, well, what does that actually say about how you impacted the research?
Absolutely. And is there anything broader for you, Ali, that you found challenging about writing this 5-minute challenge and presenting this very thoughtful critique of the way we write method sections in psychology?
I think the challenge was probably similar to the other 5-minute challenges, and that just getting up and saying something that I was worried might be misconstrued or might be seen as critiquing people's existing work. You know, it feels like a big deal to kind of stand up and, yeah, lay this challenge out. And, you know, I think it's important if we're going to present these challenges to have an idea of some suggestions on how we might improve things or do things better. So in kind of presenting that, I was nervous about how people would take that on board, and particularly given the audience, I thought it was either going to be, you know, a bit of preaching to the choir, also that, you know, researchers who I highly respect, you know, how would they take that challenge on board?
So that kind of leads on very nicely to what is the takeaway message that you want them to have? What is your operative word?
I guess that's easy, transparency. I think at the end of the day, just being transparent about your involvement and the process you've taken in research, and reflecting that in your paper or your writing or presentation.
Thank you, Ali. And I think
Thanks. Your
5-minute challenge has spoken to each of us in that we're all very aware of this jargon-loaded section that we have to write in papers. And this invitation really is an opportunity for all of us to think more carefully and thoughtfully about the writing of this section and even the reviewing of this section when we act as reviewers on other papers. So thank you very much, Ali.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Operative Word, the podcast of the International Society of Critical Health Psychology. We would love to continue this conversation with you. If you have any comments, follow our Twitter account at CritHealthPsych and or use the hashtag TheOW, short for The Operative Word.
Please don't forget to like and subscribe to the podcast and find any further information at the ISCHIP website. That's ischp.info.
You can keep up with the editorial team on Twitter too. Ali Gibson is at Ali F. Gibson. Britta Wigington is at Brit_Wig. And I am on Twitter at Brett_Scholz.